Welcome to 10,000 Posts. It's the show about how everything is posting and how we are all the product of posts of posts of posts of posts. My name is Hussein. You can follow me at hkizvani on twitter.com. As always, my co-host, who I'm sure is like much more reassured that I'm not trying to do fun intros anymore. Phoebe, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going okay.
I've just given up.
We don't do intros.
Yeah, we're a show. We're a show. Listen to it. It's good, etc. I feel like we've hit this point where, like, you know, we're getting some good following, we're getting some good reach. I would say me and you, Phoebe, we're like micro influencers at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. We've had like a few. I don't know whether you've ever got it. I actually have had people come into my Instagram DMs to ask whether I would want to advertise things on my social media page. One was a type of recyclable bamboo underwear, which I sort of regret not saying yes to, but uh-huh. I would have had to take a picture of myself in my underwear, and I really didn't want to do that because of e-girl tricks, obviously. And the second one was for a type of like cryptocurrency which stopped existing after 3 weeks, as far as I know. But anyway, we're like micro influencers, we're meta influencers, and like we like to give back. We like to use our platform to amplify lesser known voices, people who you may not hear in the media ever. You know, and for us, like, you know, for tax reasons as well, we refer to this as the Posters Charitable Trust. So in the spirit of promoting unheard voices, we're very glad to be joined by low follower account Owen Jones. Owen, how's it going? How do you feel being on a podcast?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one voice that I think really needs to be amplified right now is definitely mine. I think there's a real lack of me just generally casting my opinion on current topics. So that's great. I'm not really a person anymore. I'm just a trending topic on Twitter.
Yeah, and we'll talk about this. This is like very much the episode of today. Like, what happens when you like no longer become a person online? But look, first, I want to talk about. So, just in the spirit of this show, Owen, like when we discuss when we talk about posts, we usually start off with like a post that has gone viral recently and makes us think about stuff. You know, stuff that's happening.
Yeah, much to think about.
Yeah, there's stuff that happens in this big society we live in. And we found this post, which came on August 14th, 2021. And this was a post done by I think he's a theology professor at UBC, which is a university in Vancouver in Canada. So this is a guy called Sam Roker. Sam Roker says in this tweet, "The next person who tells me to, quote, log off will be told to get a PhD before 27, tenure before 37, write 4 books with 2 more under contract, release 6 albums/singles, produce a podcast, publish over 100 articles and reviews, guest on 12 shows, and win a university teaching award." This post went like mega viral. He's deleted it now, so I wasn't able to find like the full number, but on the Internet Archive, where I managed to retrieve it from, there was something along the lines of like 26,000 retweets. It was pretty big. So before we kind of go into talking about it, I wanted to kind of go get like your reactions to this post. Did you see it? How did you feel about it when you saw it? Are you still hooting and hollering like I am?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because when you said, "Have you seen this post?" I actually looked at it and thought I had, and I haven't because it's 3 days old. And the reason I say that is I think I've seen so many variations on this particular genre of tweet, which is somebody who essentially snaps after feeling that they're being, I don't know, somehow inundated by, you know, how dare these people dare to challenge my standing on a particular topic. And they just snap and appeal to authority in a very, 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 very cringeworthy way. I mean, I've looked at his profile, bless him. He's got a close-up of him strumming on a guitar. He's just his hands strumming on a guitar is his profile picture, which his profile background, which is kind of what I expected from this sort of guy. Yeah, I mean, the reason I found this interesting is because you often do get a certain type of British commentator and journalist who I think you often see them like sometimes you get like, "I'm a real journalist because I can do shorthand," and they feel that their journalistic credentials are being questioned or scrutinized, particularly by people on the left. And then they start going on about how they can do shorthand and that makes them a real journalist. And how dare anyone criticize their journalism when they can do shorthand, as though that's relevant to whether or not they're just regurgitating kind of mainstream, you know, bigoted views on trans people or whatever. And is this kind of, you know, often you get this by journalists about the left, because basically Twitter allows all of a sudden people to be able to scrutinize and criticize journalists in a way before they could only write letters to the Guardian's letter page. And obviously there's a big filter system. And all of a sudden they get voices they don't regard as legitimate voices trying to criticize and scrutinize them. And they get particularly angry about the left doing that because they just don't see them as legitimate voices. And they often feel they should fall back on authority.
I should clarify. So like with this guy is a left-wing like theology professor at UBC. And there's like a very fun, I was trying to figure out what the origin story of this tweet was, because what he had been doing before he posted this was that he was like, he spent his Saturday or like Friday night or whatever, because like whatever time zone he was in, debating with like trad calfs and like other calf, like accounts on Catholic Twitter about young earth theory, which is basically this idea that like dinosaurs never existed and that like everything in the Bible, like in the Old Testament, should be read literally. And he was arguing that like there are parts of Genesis in particular that are like designed to be read like allegorically, or like, you know, at least kind of bearing in mind that there are metaphors in there. I wasn't able to kind of like really understand all of it because I don't like, I'm not in that kind of section. So if there are listeners who like do understand it more, like I would like to find out more about it. But he was getting piled on by like this like section of Catholic Twitter, and then he posts this in, which is like in reference to this group, but like it just suddenly gets like stripped of all its context and becomes this like thing. And as Owen, as you mentioned, it becomes emblematic of this kind of like person online that appeals to credentialism and kind of like finds their like, you know, sense of self and authority through the fact that they've accrued all these credentials. And then coming onto a platform where not only is that like sort of rendered meaningless, but like people are actively mocked for like saying that, you know, or for asserting that they should have a higher sense of authority because of the fact that they have like PhDs and like all these other accolades that like other people don't have. And it's why like I think journalists in particular have a really difficult time on it, because, you know, for so long they've been given like platforms and they've been given prestige and they have all these types of material things, but like that just doesn't translate to Twitter. And even though like Twitter is like meaningless for like most of them, it becomes like way more important for like whatever reason. Like just the idea that there are lots of people who like, or there are more people than you like, that not only like disagree with you, but will actively like tell you you're a moron, like really doesn't sit well for a lot of kind of people who have, you know, have had this kind of authority and prestige for such a long time.
Yeah, I think it's partly that. I also think that it is an interesting mirror to the British allergy to knowing stuff, coupled with the extreme British bootlicking. So credentialism is, it's, the reason it is sort of characterized as both cringe and un-British is because, A, you're not supposed to know anything. You're definitely not supposed to talk about knowing anything. B, no one in Britain has ever managed to successfully leave school. So this is basically like someone like announcing their GCSE results, which everyone knows is the most cringe thing you can possibly do. And C, because of the bootlicking, credentials are supposed to be vibes only. So somebody who has had the kind of educational background which is afforded more or less uncritical and unthinking deference by British culture, you would never do anything so vulgar and so base as to announce it. It is supposed to be clear in every aspect of your speaking and bearing. So saying, actually, I've released six singles, it's the opposite of being the Balliol man. And whatever British people might want to say, and whatever they might pretend, is they are still utterly enthral to the spectre of the Balliol man, just as long as he is willing to appeal to this kind of imagined collective populism. I think it's very interesting on that basis. Also, as I said about it at the time, I have literally never seen anybody write dozens as 12s, And it was, which was, yeah, so that I, was something that felt, that felt very interesting to me. But also, what I think is so interesting as well is that the things that he is listing in this kind of very sort of interesting kind of LinkedIn inflected register is, it's like when, do you remember when there was that period of time when people would like publish Medium posts about like how to write a best-selling book, and it turns out that they've written like a kind of self-published thing and put it on Amazon about like, you know, well, not literally business secrets of the pharaohs, but basically business secrets of the pharaohs.
Right, yeah.
You put that together with the things that he's kind of laying claim to, and they're actually like, they're not even like especially impressive. So like, I mean, if you go into doctoral work immediately after master's or having done your undergrad, finishing by 27 is not especially remarkable. This isn't like saying like I had a doctorate at 19. It's a relatively, if you do go straight from undergrad to doctoral work, that's a relatively normal time to have had.
Right. This feels very much like you had a very normal academic career. Congratulations.
That's how long it takes. And again, with the like the teaching award, like, what, God bless you, but that doesn't mean anything. I think I have a undergrad teaching award from my brief time in the academy.
Like, la-di-da, like,
yeah,
look at,
yeah, and look at me now.
Yeah, you're on 12
of podcasts under my belt. Only one album though, so you know. So I guess he's like not doing that well.
That's the thing, isn't it? It was always going to be an exceptionally cringeworthy post, but he did it. Could you just done with a bit of maybe fine tuning, a bit of editing, because by the university teaching award makes it as massively passable as it then becomes. Like, if he'd just taken that off, it would be 10% less cringe, which is still exceptionally cringe. But I can see, yeah. I mean, Catholic Twitter, I've looked at, I mean, he's basically stood on a landmine on Twitter, and it's detonated all over his Twitter feed. And that's the trad Twitter, which I haven't really ever properly had to encounter that I'm aware of. But like, I can see them, there's a guy called Catholic Smart responding, sorry, I was too busy getting married, having children, building a community, and actually having a life of worth and value. Now log off. But that's interesting, because you can see the kind of, if he was hoping, I suppose, with that particular faction of Twitter, using his any appeal to credentials wasn't going to work, because that's not actually how they've defined the worth of their own existence anyway, is it?
I think it's so much, I think there's like such a powerful energy in like getting married and having kids just to quote tweet someone that you don't like online. I think more people, I think the left should learn from that. but yeah, so like one thing I was going to say, so he did this like follow-up thread after he went viral, which is how you know that he has like such a pure poster's brain. Like, when you sort of do this like reflective thread, which like gets very little engagement. So bear in mind that like, so if his original post or about one got like 27,000 retweets, his kind of like tweet thread explanation about what happened only got like 17. And I thought that was interesting. So when he was like explaining this, he starts off by saying, well, my quote log off tweet has been getting ratioed like crazy. Out of context, it overlaps with some internet viral patterns like pasta copy and something about Navy SEALs and feral hogs. Within context, it has made me realize that quote log off is probably not to be taken moralistically. So I'm not going to like read this whole thread, but like there is like, he kind of, on this kind of point of self-reflection, he does sort of get why like it was not only like sort of taken out of context, but sort of like just dunked on. And like, he sort of accepts that, yeah, it was a really cringeworthy post and I probably shouldn't have done it. And like, you know, credentialism is not something that like translates well online, and like not, definitely not something that, you know, I would recommend other people doing. But what the point that I think he makes is very interesting is when he sort of talks about how he was speaking to a very specific section of Twitter where credentials are deemed to be important, because like in these sort of like very online religious spaces, like the TradCaf spaces, like, you know, they, you know, for them, like authority is a key part of like living. And like, you know, there are, you know, you should have like these kind of authority figures like theologians who are there in order to kind of like guide a community. And that's why, like, you know, like priests and like friars and stuff are kind of deemed to be very important in these spaces. And, you know, quite often these religious men will be very well educated and they will have PhDs. So, you know, his mistake was coming at it from a secular position, but I can understand where he comes from in thinking that by saying that I have all these credentials and like that I have all this academic experience, especially in the context of Catholic Twitter, like my kind of thoughts on this theological issue that I have like spent my life studying for should be taken a lot more seriously than, you know, some guy LARPing as a Catholic and saying how he got married and had kids for a bit. But like, it just doesn't play out online in that way because the mechanics of online kind of I don't know if anti-authoritarian is like the right term, but it's just one where like, regardless of where you are online, like no aspect of like credentialism is ever going to like win an argument for you. Because, you know, again, and as we've said so much on this show, like you can't win an argument online. You can just get dunked on and you either have to log off entirely or you have to double down.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I do think there's something to be said for the idea of credentialism being the kind of the flip mirror to authentocracy, which I owe to Joe Kennedy. Everyone should read Joe Kennedy's book about this because it's very good. But I mean, I think the problem is that he doesn't really like. I understand the point. I do understand the point he's making, although he's made it in a very embarrassing way. But unfortunately, he's built failure into the point from the off because there was no such thing as dinosaurs. So unfortunately, he is arguing from by its origin an impossible position.
Yeah, look, as we've mentioned on the show before, like dinosaurs never existed. They were just big cows. People are like, okay, well, why do some of them have wings? I simply say, no, the archaeologists put the bones in the wrong way. No one wants to admit.
Yeah, everyone's just too embarrassed because they've gone along with it. You don't want to be that guy who goes, well, actually.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because this also comes from Twitter as well, because you can't ever admit that you're wrong.
Everyone is just, too embarrassed because of credentialism.
But that's the thing. I'm trying to work out what his game... I mean, that's the thing. He didn't have a game plan. He was just angry and frustrated because obviously it's very legitimate not to believe that dinosaurs didn't exist because they didn't. But the fact is, if you are very powerfully convinced of the non-existence of the aforementioned dinosaurs, you know, you're going to be invested in that. You're going to be extremely invested over a period of years. And someone tweeting about their university teaching award is probably not going to force you to be a test.
If you're going to spend your Friday night discussing with like lots of people online about whether dinosaurs were real and whether like the Bible is entirely literal or not, right? I don't think that saying that you got a PhD from like a kind of mid-tier university in Canada is necessarily like the most convincing argument for this type of person for whom like doing my own research has sort of meant going like, you know, just being online every single day for hours at a time. Like, you know, it doesn't, and this is the thing, like it's kind of, and I see this with journalists and I see this with like academics as well, where like they just don't understand why that kind of like epistemological process of acquiring and like understanding and reifying information just doesn't kind of like translate into a platform like Twitter. But the point is like it wasn't ever designed to be.
I'll tell you what it is. It is mid-aughts skeptic forum posting yet again. Which is having trouble manifesting on its new platform. It doesn't work on its new platform because the point of skeptics posting in the mid-aughts, and particularly this what turned out to be almost a kind of spectral, kind of phantasmagoric worry about the idea of creationism being taught in schools, which sort of turned out to be a kind of quite useful cover for various administrations in the US making all kinds of monstrous dark bargains with the evangelical Christian right, because their power was so kind of magnified and sort of blown out of all proportion, and it basically ended up with, under Obama, more or less reproductive autonomy rights being sort of sold off in exchange for his healthcare bill. And it was sort of, but it was this kind of very, very kind of seductive fear the idea that children were going to be taught that God created the earth and this happened 6,000 years ago, etc. And arguing against it did not take into account how sincerely and truculently these beliefs were held. So everything got collapsed into the over-credentialized dunk. So it wasn't about addressing or engaging in dialogue. And I do sort of understand the point because as Owen said, if someone thinks that there is no such thing as dinosaurs, they are not going to say, well, this guy has released albums. So I guess I am going to abandon my very, very sincerely held belief on this particular matter, because, I mean, a teaching award. They don't give teaching awards to just any...
Yeah, they don't.
they're not just handing out teaching awards like Sweeties. PhD at 27? The guy's a boy genius!
Every dinosaur disbeliever, there was a tipping point in the tweet about which point they realised the dinosaurs did exist. Was it the dozens of shows he'd appeared on? Was it the 6 albums and single? We'll have that tipping point.
That's definitely true. So he's trying to do the kind of mid-aughts forum look at this guy thing.
Yeah, the platform just doesn't want that. And like,
no.
The platform doesn't kind of, it doesn't like it. And again, like, you know, yeah, it's just like forum culture. It's like the return of forum culture, but like where there is no forum. It's just like that one big, do you know, like on every sort of like forum, there used to be that big general page. And that general page would always just be like filled with chaos. Like Twitter is just one big general page. And you can try to do things with it, but it just like ultimately it's always going to end up in chaos, and it'll always end up with like some people getting radicalized. And yeah, we really need to do a forum show at some point. I think we should like put that on the list. Anyway, let's move away from Young Earth Theory for the meantime. We may return to it at some point. Now look, we were kind of talking about like depersonalization and how like things get stripped out of context where ultimately like the poster ends up becoming the object to which people kind of project their like anxieties and frustrations and try to understand their place in the world in relation to this bit of digital writing. And I feel like there's no better person to talk about that with than Owen Jones. And specifically, Owen, I've asked you to come on here because we want to talk about your posts. We want to talk about why you keep trending on Twitter, why you keep trending for like reasons that I am not entirely sure. So I've made like a note of the few times that you trended recently. There was one time when I think you had mentioned that maybe at some point you would like a child, and that caused you to trend. There was the time when you were pictured with someone who was wearing a t-shirt which says we'll suck dick for socialism, and that got you trending as well. There was a third time, I can't remember what specifically it was, but it was for this very, it wasn't even something that you posted, it was like a comment that someone had made about Corbynistas, and that caused you a trend as well. So Owen, how come you're the most trended person in the UK?
It is funny this, because sometimes I get like my normie non-political friends like who I grew up with, and I'll wake up and I'll get a WhatsApp message going, oh my God, Owen, are you okay? I'm like, I don't know, what are they talking about? What's happened? And then I'm like, oh, and I don't sometimes know I'm trending. I have to kind of work. I click.
Right.
Sometimes what happens is you amass all these particular factions online who've become slightly obsessed with you, and it just takes one of them to get you trending, and then the others will jump on the whole trending bandwagon and they air all their previous grievances that they have about you. So yeah. It becomes a bit of a mess. You have to disentangle why did this all begin in the first place. So you gave an example there. I mean, the child thing was interesting because actually there was another, because often what particularly anti-trans people have become very obsessed, I suppose, with...
Are you saying that trans exclusionary people get obsessed with minor things on the internet and get very mad about them?
Like, it's interesting because they will literally, it doesn't matter what I tweet about anymore. Like I'll tweet about, I don't know, Afghanistan, climate emergency, my cats, and they'll be there. Like they will always find something. But so basically a famous example of how they always do these proxy arguments, and they sometimes,
yeah,
because transphobia has clearly rotted their brains, and they've lost, you know, any sense of any obvious perspective. So for example, last year at the height of the pandemic, I said if people could afford cleaners, then they should pay for them to stay at home. Which,
oh, I forgot about this. Yeah, cleaner discourse.
You kind of think that's actually quite, but the reason I said that is because the government released regulations allowing people to have cleaners in again. They, yeah, so then basically someone, an LBC political presenter was like, well, that's fair enough. And I was like, well, it isn't. This is a pandemic. What are you talking about? Oh, working class women should be dragged through on public transport during a pandemic. You know, that's what I spoke about. But transphobes went on and accused me of misogyny. They were like, and they accused me of having child-free privilege. I didn't know what it was like because I'm child-free.
Yeah, look, you don't have a filthy gamer husband that you need someone to clean over. You don't have children but like don't know how to wash a dish. So you just, yeah, you don't understand.
How would I understand without my non-gay? Exactly. That was actually very much instrumental in the whole discourse. and then what happened a few weeks ago is this guy I followed, lovely guy, a journalist, and he made the fatal error of writing a post which I replied to, which is, I guess, unfortunate. But basically, he posted, you know, on Facebook, they do that thing where they bring up your memories from a few like posts you did a few years ago, which is often a mixed blessing. It's like, I don't know. I can't wait to see my now dead mother. Anyway, but they posted going, I'm going to be a dad in a few days. And the reason is they co-parent with a lesbian couple. They're co-parents. Now, co-parents, for those who don't know what it is where often queer families, maybe one gay man, two gay men, one gay woman, a woman, two gay women, or bisexual women, or whatever, they raise a child together in separate households, divide the labor, and that's done on the basis of an obvious exchange where they all get to become parents. So he's been raising these kids, two beautiful kids, with a lesbian couple for years. So I tweet going, oh, you know, very jealous, I'd love to be a dad. And then it went from there, basically, where I think he showed like how it's done is in he did it through a test tube because that obviously he didn't have sexual intercourse with his co-parents. And what happened is 2 days later, the anti-trans crew jumped on it and suggested that I was trying to hunt. Well, this was me using women's bodies because they conflated it with surrogacy, which is a separate discussion altogether. And went on about, you know, and was like, you know, oh, you're not looking for trans women, are you? Because biology is real. And when biology suddenly matters to you. So then then that just trended, obviously. And then I was trending over my misogynistic desire to co-parent based on someone who I know and admire. So that was one example. The suck dick for socialism was another striking one because that was on the eve of the 2019 election. And I think it was basically, there was a whole vibe at the time because there was this famous post that went viral in the US. Some Republican had posted on their car like a big banner thing saying socialists will suck you dry. So I think I quote tweeted at the time and that went viral. So this woman, we were in a gay bar, lovely gay bar in Dalston, and this young queer woman had turned up with a t-shirt she had herself created, which was Suck Dick for Socialism, and she'd asked for me to pose with her, partly because that was a vibe at the time because of that particular post. And also, you know, it's her first post. Maybe, you know, you get some dick out of it. So anyway, I'm a gay guy. The joke was I would suck dick for socialism. I've done it for a lot less. That was the joke. That was the basis of the joke. That was the basis of the joke. Me, a gay guy in a gay bar, and I pointed at the t-shirt saying fact, as in I would suck dick for socialism. That was the joke. But then that became a whole, here's an example of the misogyny, because they work back. If you support trans rights, you're a misogynist, and therefore there's a need to work backwards. And then she became an online phenomenon. So Katie Hopkins jumped on the bandwagon and denounced her after the, I think some people blamed me for losing the 2019 election off the back of that post. I'm not joking. And she, Katie Hopkins was one example who attacked this woman going, and blamed her partly for why Labour lost the 2019 election. And she just replied, I'd better to have cum all over my face than blood all over my hands. And that went viral. She got like tens of thousands of likes off the back of that. It was one of the most liked posts in the aftermath of that election. But yeah, I mean, those are examples of, but often it is often, it's two particular factions. It's anti-trans fanatics who will literally post about, it doesn't matter what I post about. It literally will not matter. I'll post about my cat and go, oh, I bet you know what gender your cat is. It's just ridiculous. And then, that's what they do. And then, it will be kind of your kind of hard right types. And then there's the agrocentrists, and agrocentrists and anti-trans Twitter often overlap. So it's difficult sometimes to disentangle why they're particularly mad about me.
Yeah, I think like that. This is like an interesting kind of like it can be like seen very evidently in your posts, and I think largely that's because like you're fairly like well known and you have like a quite a big following. And as you mentioned like before, like you know you're one of the few kind of like left wing columnists who gets to still write in mainstream newspapers. But I think it's like also part of this like bigger kind of trend of I don't know whether depersonalization is the right kind of term. But it's one where like one thing I find when I read your posts is that like very few people actually like engage with what you're actually saying, especially because like a lot of the takes are kind of fairly like fine. Like, you know, they're not kind of like these overtly super left wing takes or like things that, you know, you could even kind of attribute as being like really, really Marxist. They are kind of like very basic observations of like a government that is very uncaring and like, you know, has like, you know, decimated public services for years. Like these are fairly obvious points that most people will kind of concede to in some form or another, which means that like Owen, your posts end up, you know, becoming less about the post, but more about like, what does Owen Jones represent in this sort of like bizarre digital space? And like for some people, like, you know, the Owen Jones represents like, you know, inherent left-wing misogyny. For others, it will be like, you know, the creeping kind of like Marxist takeover of the UK, like just all these sort of like demons that kind of like just are projected onto you. I don't know if that's like the right, whether that's like the right way of putting it.
I think that's right, because a lot of left Twitter regard me is actually very milquetoast and actually, to be honest, a bit wet, like a bit melty. I think that's actually just kind of a fair description about how a section of left Twitter do you see me. I think someone the other day suggested I had a slightly Facebook arm energy about my post, which made me laugh. But like, it's, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, especially now I find it fascinating because there's an, you know, the Zoomer left and you know, I'm now a geriatric millennial, and there is these new movements and people who've been politicized within the last 10 years who often, I suppose, would see me as insufficiently often radical and prone to succumbing to pressure or whatever. But what's interesting, yeah, I mean, I think what's happened partly is because there's a lack of left commentators with a mainstream platform. So I've got a column at The Guardian, and most left commentators don't have any full, you know, they don't, I mean, I'm on a retainer. It makes my job more insecure than it probably people think, which has all sorts of implications. But Ash Sarkar, for example, is obviously works for Navarra and then will do freelance work, columns occasionally for The Guardian or whatnot. For them, it's a totemic issue. It's a case of everything they hate about the left, they've got a convenient totem who they can project their anger and their frustration at. And I think partly since the 2019 election, partly it was a sense of, well, you know, the presence of the left was, in terms of having to take them seriously, in terms of this way they were mainstream, that was a terrible blip. It was an aberration. And now they're all expected to go and die in a ditch and never be heard of again. They're going to grovel for forgiveness. And we're not going to give them that. And what we're going to do is humiliate them and destroy them and humiliate them some more and then completely destroy them. And then obviously I'm still there and others are still there. And their frustration at the failure of the left to vanish and die then gets projected. And also part of it is, you know, and I call agrocentrists, who are often a particular brand of centrist who radicalize against the left in a very obsessive and often quite disturbing way. But what you know, when Keir Starmer took over for them, it was a sense of grown-ups are in the room, normal politics will now resume.
Finally, we're going to kill alpacas.
Exactly.
It's something that society has wanted for a long time. And the left and the Corbynista left have stopped us, but now we can go and slaughter all the alpacas.
Kill the alpacas. I mean, finally, they've got a policy. I was relieved. I was like, people say Labour have a policy.
Well, no, just as like the 10K post alpaca update, Geronimo the alpaca is not going to be executed. So he defeated Keir Starmer in the Battle of Ideas and in Posters Court too. So congratulations to Geronimo the alpaca for his
Geronimo
victory.
Geronimo versus Keir Starmer, there's only ever going to be one victor. And yeah, I mean, so for example, you know, because it hasn't gone well, to the extent where quite literally the only cut through Labour policy that we currently have is to murder cute alpacas. They don't have a good explanation for that, because they can't say the media's monstered him. It hasn't. They can't say Labour MPs have gone for him. They haven't. And, you know, they haven't got their 20 points ahead, which they did often suggest they would secure. And they don't have a ready explanation for that. About why things have gone so badly. So they just fall back on let's blame the left, and then they happen to have a convenient totem in the mainstream media ecosystem. So, I mean, in a sense, it's just a kind of, we're going to go for the left, but here's a convenient, personalised kind of manifestation of the left.
Yeah.
I think the alpaca thing felt to me like a really good, like if I wanted to come up with a good explanation of Poster's disease, I thought that was a really good example of it, because he could have avoided that whole situation by keeping silent. There was absolutely no need, considering how badly Starmer's premiership has gone up until this point. There is absolutely no need for him to have behaved in a way which ensures that the phrase less popular than a TB-ridden alpaca should be cemented in the public consciousness. But he couldn't stop himself. He had to post.
Yeah. I think he was asked, what do you kind of think about the alpaca? And I guess, like, if you were like someone who, so this for me, it's not about the posting. I think there's someone like in his team who's like actively trying to sabotage him for like, just for like Twitter fun.
I didn't think this before. I genuinely think this now. I think that there's like, I think there's a real enemy within the ranks there. I did have a question for Owen actually, and it is about like, not just like posting and depersonalization, but like kind of posting contagion, because you said that a lot of friends have found themselves at the sort of receiving end of deranged anti-OJ posting because you have quote tweeted them or replied to a post or something of that sort. So do you sort of feel like a kind of like the kind of like the holy family of posting? You're like kind of sort of going around and sort of saying, you know, can I come and stay at your inn? And people going like, no, absolutely not. You're a poison chalice. You'll bring the transphobes to me, and they'll start yelling at me about why their children can't flush the toilet. Yeah, I just think that's a kind of interesting like idea of like sort of posting personas being so strong that they kind of develop a sort of contagious sort of miasma almost.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's like an interesting and like good observation to make. I mean, I find this section very confusing, partly because I have the privilege of seeing it as like an outsider, but there's this like huge degree of obsession. And I wonder whether like, so one thing I've been thinking about is like how people like conceive of anger online and how they sort of express it, and how like, when we think about like anger and frustration and political frustration, which I think like is very universalized, but online is not a particularly good way of like expressing or doing any sort of like collective politics. So you end up having this anger, which is like directed to like certain people who become like these objects and representations. Like, I know like this is like an anthropological theory that was put out by like René Girard back in, I think like the 1980s, where he basically says that like crowd anger can only be discharged, and like it's discharged by selecting an object and attributing a kind of like amplified mythos to it in order for people to be invested in it and then to express their anger outside of it. And I wonder if like Owen then becomes this like mythological creature where it's like, you know, if you really like, you're never going to be able to defeat the left, so what you have to do is you have to put all your anger into Owen Jones specifically.
Yeah, it's like a computer game where you've got the big bosses and you kind of just take them out and then they've gone. I think that's how they've come to see it. They're like, well, we'll just cut the head off. Yeah, when obviously, actually, at the end of the day, I'm just, at the end of the day, a Guardian columnist and actually the left. Yeah. They can't they don't understand the existence of the left as a structural issue. It's overwhelmingly about younger people who have been stripped of security under neoliberalism and have progressive social values. That produces a well of sympathy for leftish ideas. And actually, you know, their view is the left is this illegitimate, weird aberration. In a way, a lot of them saw Brexit as a kind of, you know, this was this was some sort of hysteria. It was a glitch in the matrix. And, you know, this was we'll use legal means or whatever in order to stop it because it's, there wasn't an attempt. I mean, you often see this, certain centrist commentators will position themselves as we're the oasis of sanity. And these are examples of just insanity. There was no attempt to understand the structural reasons for political phenomena they didn't like. So then it makes sense to just blame to just attempt to, you know, these are monster charlatans who have, who have whipped up certain parts of society.
And this is interesting too, because I think it's like, it's this other example of like attributing power to like individuals rather than thinking about like systemic kind of fault lines and like, you know, about like historical patterns and stuff. So like one of the examples that I think is a really, well, really good example of this is Dominic Cummings, right? And like the amount of power attributed to this one man who like really lent into that mythos of being like the smartest man in the room who could like, you know, change the course of history like single-handedly. But I guess like on Twitter, you also see it in, you know, whenever Darren Grimes trends or whenever any of these other kind of like commentators, like even like Nigel Farage, for example, like when he trends, like all this power is like attributed to people, and none of that, like they don't explain why these people have power or like what makes them more powerful than others. The closest that they sort of get is like, oh, these guys they have like these big online platforms, and like, you know, they can use and leverage online as a way of like channeling their power. And I kind of think that in this weird way, they sort of attribute the same type of logic to you, Owen, where they say that, oh, because you have this like huge following of like a million like Twitter, like of a million like followers, and you have a blue check mark, you automatically have this type of like power and privilege that ordinary people in the UK don't have, and you're abusing it and you're using it to like, you know, erode and eradicate the country, and that's why you're a threat to both the Labour Party and like the union, or like whatever like they kind of want you to be, like the danger of now. It's kind of this real, like one of the elements of like having severe posters brain is this idea that like you can't really conceive of power as like a material, like, you know, or like as an effective form of materialism. You see it as just this like power exists online, and people who have power have like privileges that other people don't, and those privileges involve being able to DM whoever you want.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because once when I was, this was, I can't remember, it was a couple of years ago, it was around College Green, and I was going to do a BBC interview, and I got surrounded. Basically what happened is lots of, on the one side, kind of diehard Remainers, on the other hand, often lots of Leavers, but it was a subsection of far-right extremists who jumped on that particular cause, and they all camped around College Green, around Parliament. And what they would do is they would try and jump on particular targets, because there's lots of MPs and journalists milling around.
Yeah.
And they'd monetize it. They would, you know, chase after them,
right,
video
yeah.
them, and then get PayPals from their PayPal payments from their supporters. And then, you know, on one occasion several occasions, but this particular occasion they mobbed me and they were yelling, "You're a bully, you're a bully, you're a bully." And that, again, that was what they were kind of suggesting. And I think their angle was that I had suggested using my social media platform that a pro Tommy Robinson demonstration was smaller than had been claimed by the organizers, and that I had used my social media position to spread lies, and this showed I was this evil bully who was demonizing the good patriotic foot soldiers who'd devised and executed this fantastic demonstration on the streets. But is it just because I get this all the time? I mean, you know, this rhetoric, which is, again, I keep coming on to anti-trans activists, but they really are the most obsessed
And yeah, and like crucially, like what the most on like the most kind of like actively online as well. Like they're a really good example of like this tendency and how it translates into digital space.
Yeah, I mean, what they've done is they're people who've been radicalized online and fallen down lots of rabbit holes. And the difference between them and anti-vaxxers is one is deemed respectable and one isn't. But they're quite similar in lots of ways, actually. But they,
yeah,
I mean, and there's the, they created this idea of that everything I do or say on Twitter is a pylon. So it doesn't matter. Actually, if I write a Guardian column they don't like, that's a pylon against.
With the Guardian columns, it's inviting a pylon.
Ah, yeah, exactly.
And when you tweet something, that's also a pylon.
Once I went on television and criticised Newsnight's editorial decisions, and that was deemed a pylon against the producer. Yeah, I mean, they'll do this. I mean, like anything. I'll get people, journalists quote tweeting me, attacking me, and then I'll like reply. That's a pylon. It's kind of
right. Yeah,
I mean, they've convinced themselves that all my followers as well are this kind of drone army of my fly monkeys who will monster anyone who criticizes me. But actually, a lot of them aren't even that political. Like a lot of just, you know, on Twitter, often people follow various accounts they've seen on television or whatever because they've got a vague interest in what they have to say, but they're not actually being controlled by me and my HQ going out sending my monkeys to monster anyone who disagrees with me. But yeah, but they but that's how they, you know, it is a kind of like, you know, I've got this, you know, I mean, this is what you saw in Batley and Spen as well, because there was the, you know, I refer to the Starmer people when there was the bar election, Batley and Spen. And they were worried, obviously, that they'd lose the seat, which they only hung on to by the skin of the teeth, the Labour Party. But they were there; they were blaming me for it because I interviewed George Galloway, who I detest, by the way, but he was standing as a candidate. And obviously, my producer was like, we need to interview George Galloway. You can't do an interview about Batley and Spen without a huge part of the story. And they were like, well, that's now, if Labour lose, it's because of Owen Jones. It's like, what's wrong with you? Do you think people in Batley and Spen are talking about my Twitter feed? I mean, they'll say that. People will go, ultra Starmer supporters, if I criticise the Labour Party, they'll be like, that's why Labour's collapsing in the polls. No offence to me, but I don't actually think swing voters are sitting around my Twitter feed trying to work out, you know, deciding, well, I was going to vote Labour, but Owen Jones has said that Keir Starmer's not polling well. Like, it's just, but they decide, you know, but it is projection. It's just, it's complete and utter projection, which doesn't have any relation to reality, but it justifies as well their obsession.
Yeah, and I think like this is the thing that I see with like centrists, but also just like it's a political tendency generally where it's like where you can kind of correctly diagnose problems, but like there's no real imagination of what those solutions could be. And like we kind of scrapped any idea of like potentially creative solutions being a thing like in arguably in 2017, but also 2019, I suppose. You know, all you have left is then, well, how do you sort of explain this phenomena, which is like really difficult to explain? Well, you know, you explain it in terms of posting, and you explain that, oh, like the reason why people are alienated from Labour is because they're too obsessed with trans issues, or they're too busy doing critical race theory, or they're too busy, you know, Owen Jones is like causing the internal destruction of the Labour Party and stuff. And it's kind of like, all of these are kind of like answers you could only get from people who are terminally online. And these are the same types of people who like imagine a kind of guy who like votes for Labour and is actually like very directive of kind of what seems to be like Labour's social strategy at the moment, which is very much like we've invented a guy in our own head. That person like hates Owen Jones, loves his wife, loves his kids, simple as, and will vote, you know, and will vote Labour. And like, why aren't these people voting for us? You know, I think, yes, because so much of it is like reactive from a digital space, and it makes sense, at least like in terms of their logic, to be like, oh, this like, this kind of, you know, this digital entity, Owen Jones, not even like a person, this digital entity, Owen Jones, who keeps criticizing us and keeps getting lots of retweets from that. He's the reason why we're not successful. He's the reason why we're not kind of doing well.
Yeah, because they can't fall back on them. They can't say, well, it's because we're being, you know, because, I mean, this is the irony as well. It's kind of, well, not irony, I don't know what the word for it is really, but these are the people who would say, you know, the pointing out the objective fact that vast majority of the media monstered Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and in, you know, on a daily basis in a way that treated his leadership as completely illegitimate and morally outrageous, that making a point that had some sort of impact is seen as just falling back on excuses for the terrible failure of that project. And yet, at the same time, these are the same people who think that one Macaulay Culkin lookalike who works for The Guardian using his Twitter feed has the power to quite literally bring down the Labour Party. But they don't have a rational explanation. That's the thing. They just thought that they had this centrist magic dust, which you just scatter on the Labour Party.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, the collapse in polling under, which actually wasn't the case throughout the whole of the Corbyn era at all. I mean, they got 40% in 2017 in the general election, which I don't think Keir Starmer's leadership has much chance, as things stand, of achieving itself. But I mean, but they don't have an excuse. They just have, that's all they've got. Like, that's all they have left.
Mm.
Yeah.
If you don't have a principled core to your own politics, you don't understand it if you encounter it elsewhere. So,
right.
So that was, I think, behind a lot of the interest in casting, particularly young people having a kind of new and revived interest in sort of left-wing ideas. The idea was to cast this as illegitimate and as the result of some kind of contagious group hysteria, because everyone had got so used to politics being a product of both reaction and a lack of principled core, and that's been the case since it's been the case since New Labour, if not before. And the idea of there being something beyond what looks like the right kind of politics and what is perceived to be electable, as if electability is some sort of ethereal concept which just sort of exists and can be appealed to, as opposed to if one is able to win elections, then one is electable, which is not, it's not quite the same thing, but the insistence is that it is. I think the idea of Katie Hopkins blaming you, Owen, for the failure of Labour.
Oh no, they claimed, I won't name her, she'd be fine about it, but sure. They blamed the woman who wore the t-shirt, which she created.
Oh, I see. Okay. I think there is something very, very funny in the utter credulousness of a particular kind of posting brain, which just readily accepts the idea that otherwise Katie Hopkins is entirely invested in a Labour victory, and the only reason why she would be coming up with just illegitimate and almost sort of arbitrary reasons for the loss was because, of course, she wants to help Labour win in the future. Of course she does. I mean, why would she not? Why would you not listen to the advice of Katie Hopkins, which I'm sure is given in completely good faith and is exactly the route that one should go down? Why wouldn't you? I think that's very funny.
Well, look, just I know we haven't got too much time left, but I was just thinking, because we were talking about like politics that are like entirely reactive and how that lends itself to platforms like Twitter very well and might explain why Owen gets so many normal responses. I thought we could end the show by talking about a particularly like reactive response to a type of politics of nihilism that is embodied through a digital object which haunts me and has haunted me for a long time. And I am talking, of course, about the cry laugh emoji. And when I was going through Owen Jones's like replies to like various posts, I noticed a lot of cry laugh emojis. There have been a lot of them everywhere, like on like spaces of left-wing Twitter when you look at like, you know, how people react to certain things, but there are a lot in his mentions. And I wonder, Owen, like whether, number one, how do you feel about the cry laugh emoji? And like, number two, do you kind of like for me, I see it as this kind of digital representation of this acceptance that there are no more ideas and there is a hostility to like any form of new ideas that like might form even like not even like kind of like a socialist society, but even just like a society that's like slightly more equitable and slightly more like, isn't kind of submissive to like the richest and like the most like wealthy people in the nation. Like the cry laugh emoji feels like it's one of those ones that kind of accepts that human civilization is not going to continue and instead gloats on the idea that like, you know, if you're like on one of the upper rungs of human civilization as it entirely collapses, especially in the West, then the only thing you can do is laugh at those below you.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because it is very context dependent, because sometimes people use it in a
definitely not mad, laughing kind of way when they're actually quite aggravated. But Abby Wilkinson wrote a who's a brilliant writer and a friend, wrote a column about it for The Guardian, a crime emoji, a few years ago. And she just noted how it's often used, for example, in genuinely, obviously, just very disturbing ways. Like there'll be, I don't know, a Sky News or whatever tweet about migrants dying. See, and then, you know, having drowned partly maybe because of the EU's own hideous approach. And then it's just full of laughing emojis. And there's this kind of, inhumane triumphalism of the most reactionary elements of society. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of that meme for ages. Do you remember there's of someone, I don't know if this is real or not, but apparently someone deciding to howl in anguish at the sky in fury at the election of Donald Trump, and they posted that with the year like 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, and then post whatever year it is, like 2020 at the time, this is you here, and then 2021, 2022, you know, this is what you will be doing in the years to come. You will be howling in exasperation and despair at the sky because you are doomed. And so I think a lot of it is this kind of ecstatic triumphalism, this sense that the most reactionary elements of society have vanquished their progressive opponents, and that whenever they express their solidarity or some sort of rejection of those reactionary norms, the idea is just to gleefully ridicule and mock them in a triumphalist way.
Yeah, I mean, like, the reason why I brought it up was because this weekend in the Daily Star, which, like, for American listeners, it is a tabloid newspaper in the UK, their front page story was called "Bedwetters Decree This Smiley Emoji and It's Patronizing and Passive Aggressive. How do the little mites survive this cruel little world? It's enough to make you cry." And it had like a string of like cry laugh emojis. This was like on the front cover of a national newspaper. Bear in mind that this was also like the weekend where like Afghanistan was like falling, and like, you know, there was, you know, and even if you didn't want to like run a store in Afghanistan, there's still like COVID-19, and there's still like lots of other kind of really kind of, you know, there's climate change, there's lots of like news that not only like warrants a lot of attention but kind of says a lot about like what the future is going to look like. And the decision to kind of like run this front page, and I know it's The Star, and I know that like, you know, it's not kind of, it is not supposed to be like a broadsheet newspaper and stuff, but I thought it was still like very telling of not just like priorities, but also kind of like how this kind of sense, like, oh, and as you said, like the sense of triumphalism like plays out, where it, you know, it does so in this like, in like the most kind of stupid and like mundane way. And I think like the cry laugh emoji is really symbolic of that thing where it's like the only thing that you can do, even if like you have won the politics of like the moment, even if you are like a right wing conservative who has a government that is like giving you whatever you want in terms of like, you know, in terms of being able to buy up like properties and like, you know, you pollute the oceans and all that stuff. Like even when you have all the conditions set for you in your favor, the politics that you embody is not one of like triumphalism or one of even like sustaining this. It's just about kind of really knowing that you have it a lot better than other people, and that there are people below you that aren't only just doing badly, but they are fucking miserable.
Yeah, I think there was a lot in that. I mean, there is partly the sole winner phenomenon as well, which is people who have everything stacked in their favour in terms of, you know, that's what GB News was trying to tap into partly. It was the sense of the right might be in office, but they're not in power. And it's really the woke Marxist left who are setting the agenda and all the rest of it. But yeah, I think there's also that. You're absolutely right. I think there's a sense of this gleeful kind of sense of we have this security, economic and otherwise, which large sections of the world don't have. And there's something innately hilarious in that we have won, you know, we got the golden ticket and they didn't. And that's up to and including logging online, seeing people drowning in the ocean, having fled terrible violence, and responding to that by putting laughing emojis in a tweet and pressing reply.
And it's still like this process, like in terms of all of it, just to go back to like what we were talking about right at the beginning of the episode, like it's all kind of about these different degrees of like depersonalization and like the kind of like dehumanization that is not only kind of like a feature of political discourse broadly, but is very much like an essential component of it. Like the idea that you can, you know, it's kind of like the main means of like political participation online, which is that you kind of have to depersonalize. Like the platforms, I feel like at least like provide the incentives to like dehumanize people, like, you know, human beings, in order to kind of ascertain a position on platforms, but also to kind of like really kind of like in the search of figuring out where you are and like what you like, what your purpose is in like in society, both like digitally and offline as well. You kind of have like the incentive then is like to really dehumanize certain people so that you can figure that out. And I feel like the cry laugh emoji really is like, I don't know if I'm making sense, but it really does feel like a symbol of that complete disattachment from like the human condition, but also just any sense of like communitarianism.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a kind of, it's the most reactionary manifestation of a particular type of callous individualism, which gleefully expresses its lack of humanity in a way it wants to rub in the faces of anyone who, you know, who holds on to those values. I mean, you almost see it with kind of a lot of right-wing commentators in the public sphere. Their whole shtick really is, how much can I rile and offend the left? I mean, you know, it's going to get to the point of one of them's going to kill a cat on national television and go, oh, offended are you? Oh, offended. I mean, that's what it's because it's just kind of like, how much can we just, you know, that's, and that's partly, I think, why GB News doesn't work, because actually they want to be able to see the anger and distress of their political opponents.
They want to partake in the reactionary element of it, which is where like TV news doesn't let you do, but like where like an augmented online experience, which I think like in reference to places like GB News, like that's kind of where it's heading towards. Like the augmented experience of like participating, and like there's no better way to kind of get mass participation than to kind of wage a culture war. That's sort of like where it's at. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like Phoebe, like do you have any like strong thoughts on the cry laugh emoji?
Not really. I don't. I think there's a certain kind of hieroglyphic embodiment of a particular kind of sort of brutal and again specifically British callousness, which I find very difficult to inoculate and inure myself against. No matter how many times I see it, there's really no limit to the number of occasions I can see, say the kind of reaction to refugees drowning in the Mediterranean. There's no number of times that I can see these responses and not be utterly convinced of the thesis of the banality of evil. But I think that the specific emoji doesn't cause any particular kind of added emotional issue for me. I don't even really particularly associate it with this kind of person. I associate it with men on dating apps, but maybe that's sort of my specific allergy that is that's sort of manifesting itself there.
The best way to neg a woman is by like sending them a cry laugh emoji or printing one out and giving it to them in the club.
I prefer the printout personally.
That's right. Well, look, we're running like slightly out of time even. So do we have any last thoughts on like depersonalization or just like posts in general? I don't know, like even if it's not about posts, do you just have any thoughts that I can like mine for content like when we finish recording? Let me pick your brain. Welcome to the phrenology section of the show. Okay, on that note then, probably a good time to end. Owen Jones, thank you so much for coming on.
It's an honor. Thank you for allowing me to babble. I'm sure I'll be trending very soon, so we can...
Yeah, if you are trending, you can blame us for like... You can blame us for that.
Yeah, probably from the show. So thanks, guys. Cheers.
It was really fun to have you. If people want to like check out your work, how can they do that?
Oh, just click on my trending topic and see about all the interesting things people have to say about me, I suppose. All that, and it's all true, so that's what.
That's right. You have a YouTube channel, and you do some interesting
my podcast or YouTube. Yeah, I mean, either listen to it on the podcast or the YouTube. Take your pick. Yeah,
we will put links to both of those in the show notes, and also to like any writing that we've mentioned on the show today. You know, you can find Owen Jones. It's like, it's not that difficult to do. Just don't like, I think there is like an Owen Jones in Alabama who's like a, he does like, he's like a structural engineer, yeah, and sometimes he gets tagged in. So yeah, leave Owen Jones from Alabama alone. Thank you for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. We really, really appreciate your support for the show. You can follow us at 10K Postpod on twitter.com. You can also, for bonus content, you can also follow us on Patreon. We're on patreon.com/10kpostpodcast. Phoebe, how can people follow you?
If you want to, you can, my Twitter account is still locked, but if you would like to request it, you can request that at PRHRoy on Twitter. If you want to follow me and Milo's Seinfeld podcast, then you can at Masters of Pod.
It's a good show. You should listen to it. Lots of fun stuff happening there. This show is produced by Devon. You can follow them at Devon_onEarth. On Twitter. That's also in the show notes. And you should also follow their podcast that they do with Abigail Thorne and a good friend of the show, Alice, called Kill James Bond. It's a fun show. I really enjoy it. I have not watched any James Bond movies, and like, I still like can follow it pretty well. So yeah, listen to it. It's a lot of fun. Okay, and until next time, we will catch you later. So have a good one.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.